And we've been looking at mindfulness, the state of being aware of thoughts and feelings without judging them. Yesterday, we spoke with Andy Puddicombe, the one-time Buddhist monk whose Headspace meditation app has been downloaded millions of times by people trying to achieve mindfulness. Today, Jon Kabat-Zinn, son-in-law of historian Howard Zinn, and one of those credited with bringing the concept of mindfulness to Americans in the late 70s. He was a grad student at MIT, earning his PhD in molecular biology when he studied with a Buddhist monk and eventually developed the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, or MBSR, program for pain patients at the University of Massachusetts Hospital. It did make patients feel better, and people suspected it also rewired the body. And then last year, Harvard released a study using MRIs that showed meditation did change brain structure. It thickened the cerebral cortex, an area associated with attention. It added density to the hippocampus, which is associated with self-awareness. So for more on what's happening, let's bring in Jon Kabat-Zinn. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So nice to see you. Where are we since you started looking at this? And people like Ellen Langer, we always give Ellen credit for her first mindfulness studies.
The technology's evolved. So now we can look at, say, what happens in the brain, brain structure. That's a whole field called neuroplasticity. There's also what goes on in the chromosomes and in gene expression. And that's a whole new field called epigenetics. And then there's what goes on at the ends of all of our chromosomes, the telomeres, which are associated with aging. And there are very interesting things that happen when people actually shift from doing to being, and that you can see major changes in brain structure within 8 weeks, the hippocampus that's involved in learning and memory. The reason we're into this is because of the results, because the real reason that mindfulness is valuable is that it's intrinsically valuable for its own sake, that your life improves.
Talk about what that is. You said move from doing to being. What is that?
Well, how to actually learn to rest in the domain of your own being. That's what meditation really is. And that involves wakefulness.
I think I am awake. I'm wide awake right now. Yeah. What is wakefulness?
Relatively speaking, we're all more or less zoning along on autopilot in a kind of consensus hypnotic trance. So we think we're awake, but we're not actually awake in the way that I'm speaking about it. Are you in touch with being embodied, or are you mostly living up in your head above the neck?
What do you mean by that, being embodied? Am I feeling my feet while I'm sitting here talking to you?
Yeah, are you feeling the sensations of the air on your skin, the breath moving in and out of the body? And what mindfulness does, it's like exercising a muscle that continually recognizes, oh, I'm not fully present, let me come back. And then the devices make it much worse because, you know, you could say, well, why would I want to be in this moment? It's so bloody boring. Let me read the newspaper or do something to fill up this moment with something more interesting. Let me check my messages or my Twitter or whatever to just see. So we're continually distracting ourselves.
So let's say I want to do what you just said. I want to exercise that muscle. I want to become more mindful. And that brings us to meditation.
Yeah. Get an app.
Get an app?
Get the Headspace app and play with it. And I'm being slightly facetious, but I think that if that is what will work for you, it's like, how do you fight a forest fire? You fight it with another fire. In the same way, you can use the technology to actually extinguish some of the addictive elements of the technology.
Interesting. Well, you also had CDs.
Well, yeah. I mean, guided meditations are nothing new, and we use them all the time with people. And my guided meditations are iPhone apps and, you know, on Google Play and so forth as well.
So let's just do a little of it. Let's say I'm one of the pain patients, for instance, and you've asked me to sit still and maybe I'm starting to meditate. Immediately, I'm starting to think about, I hurt, I ache. How am I going to pay for this? I can't go to work. I can't.
Exactly.
So what do I do with all of that?
Well, for somebody who's in chronic pain, very often they've had all the various medical treatments and so forth. And when they come to us, they basically haven't worked so well. There's no alternative but to, in some sense, do what seems counterintuitive. You put the welcome mat out and you turn towards the sensations in your body that you're calling pain. And you say, in this moment, could I just be with these sensations for even, say, one in-breath? Or if that seems like too challenging, half an in-breath and just feel it. People will say, well, I don't want to feel my pain. I want someone to cut it out or give me a pill or whatever it is. But the irony is with hundreds of chronic pain patients that we've done studies with, when we invite them to actually put the welcome mat out for whatever the stress or the pain is that they're experiencing, they actually befriend it. And they learn, you can live with this. Sometimes the actual pain will go away. But even if it doesn't, you can transform your relationship to it so that it no longer erodes the quality of your life.
Is this the part of mindfulness that you talk about, not judging it? Why can't I quiet my mind? Why
right.
can't I?
Well, exactly. As soon as you try to do it, you'll think, oh, maybe I'm not doing it right. Maybe I should be breathing
judging.
More deeply. Or all of those things are called, do you know what they're called, Robin? They're called thoughts. Okay? And we sort of, in some sense, suffer from the disease of actually mistaking our thoughts for the truth. And this is a huge source of suffering, a huge source of anxiety and stress. So once you recognize that a thought is like an event in the field of awareness, then those thoughts are like weather patterns. They're like storms in the mind, and you no longer have to be at their mercy. You just notice that's a thought, and you come back to the experiencing of the body sitting here breathing, for instance. All that neuroscience and all the, you know, sort of epigenetics and all of the new science is saying that if you cultivate this quality of non-judgmental moment-to-moment awareness, the brain, your organ systems, everything, they have their ears to the rail, and they will actually transform. You can learn to actually modulate or surf the waves of those kinds of comings and goings. And that's what the non-judgmental piece means.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that you won't be judgmental. You'll be utterly judgmental, but you don't have to judge the judging.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, I'm sitting here holding the big new reissue of your book, Full Catastrophe Living. There's, for instance, suggestions for mindfulness of food and eating. The story always goes that you have people sit and look at a raisin for like an hour. Is that true?
It's a little bit of an exaggeration. I have people eat as their first experience of meditation rather than sort of sitting in the full lotus posture or something like that. And just have them take two raisins and eat them over a period of
maybe. Oh, so it's two raisins.
It's only two. And eat them over a period of 15 minutes, one at a time.
What does that do to eat that slowly?
Well, first you look at it, as you were suggesting, and you actually see it. Most of the time when we eat, we're not looking at what we're putting in our mouths. So then you can feel it and get a kind of sensory experience of the landscape of this thing that you are actually going to take and put in your body.
And what does it do when you're mindful about a raisin?
Well, most people say, I don't think I've ever really tasted a raisin before in my life.
I have to say, The New Yorker, which got us thinking about all this, talked about going to one of your sessions, and there was a woman in the session who stared at her raisin and slowly ate her raisin. And she said her thinking was the raisin made her start thinking about grapes, which made her think about wine, which made her think, I really want a glass of wine. And that's okay. Don't judge that.
Exactly. You see, that's actually a very beautiful statement, because if we can hold in awareness the deep interconnectedness, then, you know, as some Buddhist teachers like to say when they do similar kinds of exercises, you might ask you, can you see the rain in that shriveled up raisin? Can you see the sunlight? Because they all are preconditions for this thing being in your hand and going into your mouth.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, we know you've got your mindfulness-based stress reduction program now around the world, hundreds of programs.
Yeah, over 700 at last count. So.
And what companies have approached you? You know, somebody who
wants
to know
about... MBSR at Google. There's MBSR at Apple, at Aetna. I did not create MBSR for it to be the kind of singular entry point, one doorway into wisdom and compassion. There are an infinite number of doorways. Google has Search Inside Yourself, which is a mindfulness-based program for their engineers. But they've also had MBSR there for many, many years. And it's basically a deep interior resource that's inside of all of us and available with a certain kind of drilling down into the essence of who you are.
That's Jon Kabat-Zinn. The second edition of his book, considered one of the Bibles on mindfulness, is Full Catastrophe Living, Using the Wisdom of Your Body and Mind to Face Stress, Pain, and Illness. Jon, thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, it's absolutely my pleasure. I love the name of your program, of course, Here and Now. Being here now is always a good idea.